Hello, I am John Cryer, and welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. In our last episode of Undisclosed, Omar 60 and Walnut, the team delved into the account of JR, one of Terrence Lewis's supposed accomplices, and Susan spotted a new piece of evidence that had those of us at home screaming, "Brady violation!" at the top of our lungs. So with us this week is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of Undisclosed. He's also an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and he blogs at Evidence Prof Blog. Hey there, Colin. Welcome back.
Hey, John.
And we have Susan Simpson. She is also a host of Undisclosed, and she's an attorney at the Volkov Law Group. She blogs at viewfromll2.com. Welcome, Susan.
Hey.
Hey, and also with us today is Xavier McElreth Bay, who's a senior advisor and national advocate at the Campaign for the Fair Sentencing of Youth. He's also a co-founder of the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network, telling the stories of leaders who were formerly incarcerated as youth. And Xavier has been fighting to abolish life without parole for children in America, and in recent years has played a role in ending the practice in several states, including Nevada, Utah, Arkansas, South Dakota, and North Dakota. Welcome to the show, Xavier.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So I have to say, your story is extraordinary. My understanding is that by the time you were 13, you'd already been arrested 19 times. So can you tell us a little bit about how your life came to that place?
Yes. Most of my arrests, interesting enough, came very, very fast, beginning at the age of 9 years old when I was arrested for, you know, it may sound funny, but stealing a candy bar from a grocery store. And when that happened, obviously, I was just a very young, impetuous, risk-taking, you know, nine-year-old who obviously didn't think ahead. And I paid a heavy price, was arrested, was taken to the police station. My mother signed me out. And it was a little traumatizing, I have to admit. But sadly, it was really just indicative. That particular arrest was indicative of the poverty I was living in, the struggles I had at home, the lack of structure, and really just extreme abuse, neglect, and other factors that unfortunately didn't really mean much to the justice system at that time. At that moment, I was just an offending youth. And by the time I was 13 years old, I had already been involved in gangs, had already committed multiple arrests, had already unfortunately been placed in detention 7 times, had been a victim of a gunshot at the very young age of 11 years old. And sadly, at that very same age of 13, I was sent into the Department of Corrections for a 25-year sentence for first-degree murder. I was guilty. I pled guilty. And receiving that sentence, obviously, at that age, it seemed like light years away that I'd ever be free. I had very little hope. But I was fortunate to have people who advocated for me, who believed in me, who surrounded me with a community of care, in particular, a public defender, a wonderful, very supportive minister and priest who worked in the juvenile detention center, a great GED instructor, a wonderful college professor. There's many people that I met along the way that helped instill the belief within me that I could change and that I could do something better in my life. And fortunately, I had that opportunity. Unlike many in our justice system, I did have a light at the end of the tunnel. And because of that, I believe as maturity and remorse began to evolve in my life, I became more confident in my ability to come out and start anew. And thankfully, I've been out now for 15 years. Came out at age 26 with a bachelor's degree. Today, I have a master's degree. I have a six-year-old daughter. A very typical life, a very normal life, you know, despite the travel and occasional speaking engagements and being able to, you know, talk on a podcast with wonderful, amazing people who I look up to. Is, you know, other than that, I would just say that, you know, I'm blessed to have a normal life, to have the ability to live, breathe, and recreate myself and start, you know, a new life in free society versus having to live out, you know, the existential nightmare of a life without parole sentence, which is what they could have given me when I was 13.
Can I ask you, was there a moment that you realized that there was hope? I mean, I imagine you're 13 years old, you're incarcerated, you've already been arrested, 19 times at that point? You know, I have to say, when you told me that story about stealing a candy bar, I had friends that did that. You know, I myself was tempted to do that.
The idea of a 9-year-old being arrested for anything, let alone that,
yes, is
sickening.
Yeah.
And especially if something
that's
not
sickening.
Even, I mean, I'm struggling to think of any crime that Weston had. The idea that a 9-year-old could be put, arrested, taken by the cops for a crime that probably most kids at some point do something like that. That's insane.
Yeah. And I look back upon that experience, you know, it's funny because that wasn't the very first time that I was placed into a squad car, you know, and the very first time I was placed into a squad car was when I was 6 years old. And that's when I was taken away from my mother. And it just seems to be the dominant theme throughout that whenever I engaged with law enforcement, whenever I was engaged with many systems and institutions, sadly, they're mostly antagonistic, re-abusing and re-traumatizing for me. And so, yeah, looking back at the age of 42 today to a 9-year-old child who was arrested for such a, you know, insignificant thing, you know, I'm happy to say that we've come a long way since then, but we certainly have a lot more work to do.
So after that kind of an experience and not it sounded like your home life was abusive and you didn't get any support there. How did you fall in with gangs at that point?
Well, you know, it's funny, you know, it started off with just having close friends in the community who, you know, may have had similar experiences to mine. You know, they you know, and when you live in a community that's very much, you know, very much contending with poverty and this is real with crime and violence, and it's a general sense of, you know, a lack of safety. You know, sadly, you know, you tend to think that you have to be more aggressive to survive in these environments. And for a child especially, you know, that is a scary thing. And so I think that what happened with me and some of my closest friends, you know, we got caught up with older guys who just took advantage of our loyalty, you know, and really just trying to, you know, for us to fulfill some of the most basic and fundamental human needs, but for them, sadly and unfortunately, it meant having, you know, youth who were ripe for the occasion of impulsive, destructive behavior, which advanced the cause of the gangs that were out there. And sadly, you know, before we realized it, we had destroyed our lives altogether.
So as I was saying, you're incarcerated and, you know, you're 13 years old. You're in a what I'm sure was an incredibly scary place to begin with. Not that the streets weren't scarier, perhaps, but my question is, how long did it take before you finally had hope again? Before you know, what steps made you say, you know what, maybe I've got a chance here?
It's funny because I have to say, you know, I look back upon when I was serving, and it's not like the heavens opened up and the light came shining down on any given day or year, for that matter. I have to admit, positive change for me was gradual. Just as much as it, you know, it took time for me to learn a lot of bad habits and, you know, and ways of being. And sadly, I had to hit my head a few more times to wake up and along the way just realize that certain things weren't working in my life, you know. And one of those things, obviously, was being a part of a gang. And that was one of the hardest decisions, that is leaving the gang when I was 18 years old and when I was in one of the most violent prisons in our state, which was Pontiac Correctional Center, which was referred to as a Thunderdome at that time. But I was in segregation. I was placed in solitary confinement for a year for assaulting a correctional officer during a gang riot. And during that year, it was one of the first times I had such a long time, in fact, to just be alone, to reflect upon my life. I was receiving letters from my family. My mother was still contending with mental health problems. My brother was still contending with schizophrenia and depression. My sister had just joined a gang, and here I was, you know, I was in prison serving 25 years for gang activities and my involvement in a gang-related murder. So it was just a lot that was happening for me at that time. And then also, I think I just grew spiritually as well, you know, just really questioning the meaning of life, you know, what, like, where's my life, you know, leading to? And interesting enough, you know, it became very clear one day when I was in the yard. I was in our very small yard, which was really used only for inmates who were in segregation. And while I was there, there was four or five other, you know, inmates there with me. And I remember I looked across the walkway to a smaller prison yard, and I saw this individual playing basketball by himself. It wasn't the first time that I saw him playing basketball by himself, but I remember asking one of the guys that were there, like, "Hey, man, you know, what's to that guy over there? Why isn't he over here with us?" You know, and my logic at the time, I had assaulted a correctional officer, but even I was able to interact and mingle with other inmates. But this individual was kept completely, you know, isolated from everyone. And I remember the gentleman telling me, he said, "You know, that guy's on death row." And in that moment when he said that, I didn't really know how to process that. I looked over across the walkway again. I tried to, you know, search out his face. I tried to understand what he was going through. I couldn't imagine what it's like to be on death row, you know. And I st- started to question the meaning of his life, you know, and I just really, things were just really making me think. And I realized that Xavier, you know, if you continue on the path that you're on, you know, that's where you could be next, you know. But I also thought to myself that, you know, how easy it is to destroy ourselves, to throw it all away, you know, and I didn't want to do that. You know, I understood at that time, as I began to mature and think more clearly, I realized that a lot of my experiences and a lot of my decisions were really not indicative of who I really was inside, but that in fact, I was really acting out of some very unmet and unaddressed needs and concerns that existed in my life. But sadly, because of that, you know, those traumas manifested in a very devastating way. But as an adult, you know, perhaps I can do something better. Maybe I can stand up. I can allow myself to heal, to think about a brighter future and strive towards better things. And it was then that education became my priority. And because of that, I was able to refocus myself, come out of solitary confinement, leave the gang, thankfully unharmed, and start a new journey.
And was that when you started pursuing the higher education, getting degrees?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
And that must have seemed like just an entirely different life for you. I mean, because you were incarcerated at the time you were 13. I mean, that's, you know, kids are still they're in middle school at that point. They're just learning to take different classes and just, you know, to adjust to the idea of, okay, I'm going to pursue a college education. That's just an incredible leap in my mind.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, for me at that time, you know, I did have some confidence, you know, thankfully at that time in regards to academics and my education, because when I was in the juvenile detention center, when I was in IYC Joliet, I met a G&D instructor who, you know, instilled this sense of hope that I can, you know, excel academically, that if I applied myself, that I could do something better. And I remember going into this class for the first time and him giving all of us an assessment, and to discover that I had a 6th grade point average, to me was quite embarrassing. But he assured us that if we work together, if we commit ourselves to the work, and if we listen to the instruction, that we can pass. And he was confident about that. And within 8 weeks, I came to discover that my next assessment actually identified my grade level at a 12.9 across the board. And I was just really amazed, like, wow, like, I could do this, you know?
Uh-huh.
So... yeah, so I just have to say that, you know, by the time I was in Pontiac and started taking confinement, you know, I had a sense of what I could possibly do in my life, but it was very challenging because, you know, leaving the gang for me was almost like a psychological castration. You know, I didn't really know who I was apart from the gang. It was a very emotional. It was emotionally draining. It was actually very fearful. I literally, you know, remember when I left out of solitary confinement, I had torn up a photo album that I had in my possession. And I had put 4 holes in it, 1 in each corner. And I remember tearing the thick lining of my sheet, and I placed 1 string to the other side, and I created a loop to put around the back of my head. And I put 2 additional strings at the bottom, and I tied it around my back because I feared that, you know, if the gang were to attack me, you know, I wanted to at least be able to protect my vital organs. You know, I wanted to be able to survive an attack because I knew that if it did attack me, it would only be a one-time thing. And if I survived that, then I could continue on the path towards something positive. And I think, you know, an 18-year-old kid in prison having to withstand that, having to endure, you know, sleepless nights, you know, not knowing what to anticipate and feeling very little support, you know, it's sad that many kids have to make those decisions. But I'm very thankful that I had the spiritual guidance and spiritual confidence and being able to move forward. And thankfully, you know, I was unharmed. And thankfully, those who I thought would be my enemies became some of my greatest supporters. In fact, it was the actual gang. It was actually the gang leadership that put me in college when I made my decision.
I am really surprised at that. I have to say, you don't hear about that much. Now, you yourself were not a juvenile lifer. My understanding is that you were sentenced to 25 years.
Yes. I was given 25 years, and under the old law, which was a day-for-day provision, you were allowed 1 day of good time for every positive day that you served. And so ideally, I could have been out of prison in under 13 years, but because of some earlier infractions, I got out after 13.
Mm-hmm. So obviously, you've been sensitized to the people who are juvenile lifers, people who are stuck in this horrible situation. One thing that struck me as very interesting about the Supreme Court ruling on it was that it wanted to leave the states with the possibility that they could still do it. It said, you know, this is a terrible form of punishment. However, we want to leave you guys some wiggle room in case you really think you need it.
They've not banned juvenile life sentences. So they're still entirely constitutional. It's just they can't be mandatory.
I know this is the era of swiping right or swiping left, but to be honest, you can't really get to know somebody just by looking at their picture. And I can't tell you how many single friends I have who are tired of that scene. But eHarmony is different than almost every other dating site online. They take steps that other dating sites don't in order to find you a more compatible match. One of my friends has found her soulmate and been married for a number of years now using eHarmony. Another one of my friends just signed up very recently for eHarmony, and I talked to her about it earlier this week, and she told me that what she loved about it was the fact that it took a little bit of effort to create your profile. That means everybody who's on eHarmony is serious. They're not there for a shallow hookup. They're there to find lasting, meaningful relationships. And another thing she mentioned was the fact that she loves the fact that eHarmony focuses on values, asks about your values, and brings together people based on values. eHarmony has helped over 1 million people find their perfect match. They bring compatible people together. There are plenty of hookup sites out there. This is not one of them. So, right now, our listeners are getting a free month of eHarmony when they sign up for a 3-month subscription. Enter my code UNDISCLOSED as checkout. Once again, enter my code UNDISCLOSED at checkout to get a free month with eHarmony when you sign up for a 3-month subscription. So stop waiting and start your journey to a satisfying, meaningful relationship. It can be fun to play around with online dating apps, but when you're ready to fall in love with somebody and have a real, meaningful relationship, there's one app that's built to bring you real love, eHarmony. Come see how eHarmony can change your life. Go to eHarmony.com and get started and enter our code UNDISCLOSED at checkout.
Do you think that there are any circumstances that actually would justify a juvenile life without parole sentence? I can't think of any.
And this is one of the reasons I think the juvenile life sentences have met opposition. It's not so much that people, well, they do want to have licensed juveniles. They're in favor of that, but they're more scared, I think, of the creep. It is hard to make a firm line saying at 17 you can't go to prison for life, and after that you can. And they're worried it's going to spill over and affect constitutional law down the line. And theoretically, the court could reach a point where it says it's not constitutional to ever have mandatory life sentence.
But I get a sense, if you look back, for example, to some of the earlier U.S. Supreme Court decisions, some of the things that have come about in recent times, you almost, could have seen it, over a decade ago. For example, in 2005 in Roper, when they banned death penalty for children, they talked about how children are different. They talked about, how children are less culpable. Miller reinforced that by saying, that children are less culpable, and that, the judges and making these, these decisions upon a child's life, that the judges should, consider this diminished culpability. And they should consider the hallmark features of youthfulness, and that whether, and then resentencing more recently, there's been a lot of emphasis upon the importance of recognizing, whether a person has changed since that offense. And so, we look at, Montgomery, the question of whether a person is irreparably corrupt for us. We recognize that every child, because their brains are informed, because the prefrontal cortex has yet to be fully formed, that children still have the great capacity for change. And of course, recognizing that capacity, we urge that no child should be sentenced to life without parole.
Yeah, and John, the bottom line for me is people fight against the death penalty, and they say there's only 58 countries that have the death penalty. And only 5 countries, including the U.S., make up 95% of executions. Well, juvenile life without parole, United States is literally the only country in the world that sentences juveniles to life without parole. There's not a single other country in the world that allows for a juvenile to be convicted, sentenced, and have no chance of being released for the rest of their lives.
So why would that be? I mean, what is it about us in the United States that we feel that this is plausible? I don't know what level of fear we're in that feels appropriate.
Yeah, unfortunately, we remain to be extraordinarily punitive, as a country. Henry Montgomery, the petitioner in the Montgomery case, he's still incarcerated after 54 years. His parole hearing was recently postponed. And, it's sad because, here it is, many others across the country are receiving relief, but yet he's still in there. Since Miller and Montgomery, there have been serious momentum in terms of state legislation. It's amazing that, states are banning, these sentences outright, at an unprecedented rate. Today, for example, there are over 20 states plus the District of Columbia that banned lifetime parole altogether. You know, in 2012, that number was just 5. So even though we're the only country in the world that does this, and even though, you know, sadly, we defy some of the, you know, some of the most recognized conventions, you know, that are out there, international conventions, or particularly the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which states that neither capital punishment or life without parole, you know, should be imposed upon children, you know, we are seeing some progress. And so I think it's worth mentioning that, you know, through the course of this conversation, that change is happening. But yet, one state that allows it, you know, or one poor resentencing is one too many.
Now, on the show this week, you talked about the case of Johnny Berry, who was a juvenile lifer in Philadelphia, and that he had negotiated a deal for probable immediate release on parole, but he's still pursuing a claim of actual innocence. But what were the circumstances of that case?
That was a case very similar to Terrence Lewis. He was a juvenile lifer. He was convicted for a murder in Philadelphia a few years before the murder of Bernard Howard. And like Terrence, he had an accomplice that was involved in the crime who since submitted an affidavit saying that he was not involved in this murder. And with Larry Krasner taking over as DA, his attorney was able to negotiate with the Philadelphia DA's office. And he is still allowed to pursue his claim of actual innocence, but he is eligible for parole immediately. And that, as I tweeted out, gives great hope to us, and I mentioned on the podcast as well, that a similar deal possibly could be struck in Terrence's case.
Because even if he is released, he's still got the stigma of having been convicted of a crime that he did not, in fact, commit.
Right. A lot of these district attorney's offices will sort of have a Hobson's choice. We might even mention one later in this episode where essentially to get out, you have to either admit guilt or give up your claim of actual innocence. And right, the tea leaves here with Larry Krasner's offices, it seems he's willing to allow for people to negotiate a release or at least a possibility of release while still being able to pursue their claim of actual innocence.
Here's a bit of a thought experiment. For a juvenile who is given a sentence of life with the possibility of parole, what is the latest a juvenile should be eligible for parole? Do we have a general amount of time, or do we just leave that up to judges to their judgment?
Yeah, you know, it's for me personally, and reflecting upon my own experience, I have to say it didn't take decades for me to change for the better. I think that, you know, generally speaking, what these resentencing hearings are about is assessing whether or not a person has done that, whether or not a person should be, you know, eligible to be released, whether that person is still a threat to society, whether that person has, you know, taken advantage of the opportunities and resources and programs that have been made available to them. And so, you know, we've seen mostly, you know, for the most part, that the majority of those individuals who have served decades tend to be some of the most, you know, model, you know, inmates. You know, they tend to be in high positions within the institution. They tend to run, you know, programs themselves, often working in violence prevention. You know, they often, you know, are writers, poets. You know, they're often involved in just simply, you know, expressing, you know, their hopes for something more and for their state and those who are like them. They often in that vein become advocates themselves. You know, and so, you know, one great example, you know, of a resentencing recently, in fact, it was in Pennsylvania. You know, that would be that of Campus Songster, you know, who was released, you know, from prison just last December after serving over 3 decades in prison, you know, since he was 16 years old. You know, it's sad that he had to wait so long. Fortunately, he's out. But, you know, looking at the state of Pennsylvania, you know, Campus became one of over 200 juvenile lifers who had been resentenced in the past year. You know, one of over 100 that have been released in Pennsylvania in the past year. And to my surprise, and what I found out recently, he's the one and only former juvenile lifer that I know of who will be going to the Super Bowl with the Philadelphia Eagles, Malcolm Jenkins. So, yeah, just, you know, I can't think of I wouldn't call it a happy ending, but certainly indicative of our moves as a nation towards, you know, something more meaningful and positive for our youth. You know, I mean, if you think about, you know, these sentences are a larger national, you know, a part of a larger national conversation, you know, on criminal justice reform, you know, and that is thankfully taking hold, you know, as evidenced by, you know, mass incarceration crisis. You know, our justice system is overly punitive and steeped in the history of racial inequality. And, You know, we must begin it by, you know, protecting the most vulnerable among us, you know, with efforts to reform youth sentencing. But that is just one battle, you know, in a larger war, you know, to become a more compassionate society, a more rehabilitative society, I believe.
One thing they mentioned in the episode was that more than half of all conviction review units haven't issued a single exoneration, and that that was due to understaffing and other issues. But what are the other issues? I mean, it was great to hear his criteria of what, you know, what cases they take on and what cases they, you know, and how they do that. But is this all new territory for these conviction integrity units? I mean, they're still pretty new. Who's writing the rules?
Yeah, there was a great report. It was done at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, so right in Philadelphia. It's called Conviction Review Units, A National Perspective. And they have basically three criteria they think are essential to an effective conviction review unit. And each of those has several different bullet points. So one of them is independence. And the key there is that the CIU report directly to the DA and be independent from the prosecutors, especially those who prosecuted the initial case, that there be training for the CRU personnel on the reasons we have wrongful convictions. In terms of flexibility, it's things such as allowing a person who has pled guilty to be able to appeal their conviction. A lot of CRUs don't allow a person who has pled guilty to be able to appeal. And then in terms of transparency, it is making sure that the public sees exactly what they're doing, to consider time served as a possible remedy, to make sure that a person who has been exonerated by the CRU is not going to be re-prosecuted by the prosecutor's office, and just making clear to the public, here is how a person would file for relief for the CRU, and here is how our process works. So that's a really great document. I think Larry Krasner, in reforming the CRU in Philadelphia, is looking at that. But that 17-point punch list is something that explains, I think, why over half of these CRUs don't have a single exoneration. A lot of them violate the tenets of transparency and flexibility.
Well, as I said, it's new territory, and I think people in office are still terrified of appearing soft on crime at this point, and administrations are terrified of releasing that person who goes on to commit another crime. But, you know, any human is capable of committing a crime. We like to think that there's some indicator that says, you know, this is a person who, you know, cannot be allowed around the public. But it's all, you know, there's still an enormous amount of guesswork, you know, involved in these things. Actually, Colin, you mentioned something at one point during the podcast. You said it's the sentence and not the conviction that governs criminal appeals. I didn't understand exactly what you meant by that.
Yeah, so, you know, we've mentioned a few different procedural hurdles that apply in different cases. So in the Adnan Syed case, we mentioned how in Maryland there's this 10-year statute of limitations for bringing an appeal, which is part of the issue with the cell tower claim. We mentioned under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act how there's this 1-year statute of limitations after a person has appealed in the state court. And so what I'm saying with regard to that is there's two things that could happen in a defendant's appeal. One, the court could throw out that person's conviction and say, oh, there was a Brady violation, the jury instructions were problematic. Or the court might say, as in these Miller versus Alabama cases, this juvenile was given life without parole. We're going to have a resentencing hearing. He's still guilty of the crime. We're going to resentence him to, say, maybe life with eligibility for parole after serving 20 years. And so the point I was making in the podcast is to say, in a case like Terrence Lewis's case, even if his conviction is not thrown out, but he's given a resentencing hearing and he's given a new criminal sentence, that resets the clock. And all of a sudden, all the procedural issues at play in his case go away because it's as if he has a new conviction because it's that new sentence that sets the appellate framework.
Thank you. Okay, now I feel better. Because that was a head scratcher for me. Well, I wanted to get into a lot of the stuff that went down in the last episode. Mostly also, Susan, so you had another eureka moment. Obviously, this, you know, you're not the first person. The defense attorney got the documents. But do you remember the eureka moment that you realized that this must be Starr?
Well, it was more the possibility occurred to me. And then going back to check and realizing it fit. Because I think we just assumed basically it couldn't be her. And it made it really hard to figure out where this page of interview notes came from then. But once I went back to check, it all kind of started falling in place pretty easily. And I was convinced pretty quick, I think. So I sort of put up a a summary of my findings from the columns. Like, am I crazy here, or is this check out to you too? And Colin agreed. So at that point, we knew we had something.
Mm-hmm. Is anybody contesting whether or not that's a true reading of the evidence?
Not at this point. It's pretty clearly from Star. And I know that the Philadelphia CRU has been working to try and investigate further, hopefully talk to the detective that took the notes, as well as some of the witnesses in the case, to see if they can figure out more.
I only bring that up because, obviously, this was evidence turned over by the state. So it's not, you know, there's no question of its provenance. It's just a matter of whenever there's wiggle room, generally the state finds it and uses it if possible. But it would be nice to believe that they took it at the face value that it seems to present.
Yeah, I think in this case, for once, it's ironclad enough where there aren't that many possibilities, and you can rule out all the other ones definitively, which leaves Star.
And I had another question. So, it was great to hear JR's account in the podcast. Does it ring true to you guys?
I don't think we know enough to say. That's kind of where I'm at. It's not that we do have witnesses who saw people coming into the house, some in a car and then someone else on foot. So it's not impossible that they were separate entities that were not connected and not working together. And I definitely don't believe it proves JR's guilt beyond reasonable doubt to any extent. But at the same time, I couldn't say I really have a feeling one way or another. What about you, Colin?
Yeah, I can't say 100%. And Susan, you might know this better than I do. At the time that JR gives this story of sort of arriving separately on foot and then leaving separately, is there any reason we have to believe that he would be aware of any other witness at that point who would have said two men arrived in a car, the third man arrived on foot, and they left in different directions?
You know, was he sequestered? I mean, theoretically, Kizzy.
Yeah.
She'd be the only witness who could have at the time. And he did testify after her at the habeas.
Right.
I'm assuming he wasn't in the room. I don't know that for a fact, though.
Yeah, same as Susan. I'm not sure. Obviously, he has a reason. He was friends with Terrence. He would have a reason to lie on his behalf. So I don't know how much credibility I can give it. But yeah, I mean, to that point, I would wonder, because it is striking how his version of events, that these other two men were already there, I arrived separately, I had nothing to do with them. In fact, we had a bit of a conflict a day or two earlier, and then we left in separate directions. It's striking how that matches up with some of the later witnesses who come forward. And so I wonder, was there any chance where he could have gotten that from someone else? If not, the fact that it matches up, I think, does, in my mind, give some credibility to his accounting.
At the same time, Denise didn't seem to perceive any difference between the guy who was JR and the other two. That just doesn't mean that there wasn't some sort of like different groups there, but she, as the witness in the room, didn't perceive these three men as acting on two different sides. And also, it seemed strange to me that JR was trying to collect a drug debt from Star at the same time that someone else was there to collect a drug debt from Bernard. And going back to the case a bit, there are a few more details here that remain sort of unestablished, or to me anyway, remain question marks. Like the pager number. We know from the very first episode and the first police files that when the police ask Star who did this, she tells them Mello, and she gives them a pager number and says it belongs to Mello, and his name could be either Jamal or Jamar. And Jamel Lawson, aka Mello, later challenges and says no, it wasn't his pager number at all. And I kind of wonder if, in fact, she was confused. What the number she gave them was actually JR's number. Unfortunately, given that his real name is Jamar and Mello's real name is Jamel.
Jamel, yeah, it's very close.
It's hard to tell what Star actually said initially, or if she knew the difference. And for all we know, it could be a coincidence. I mean, it's really hard to say what Star was trying to communicate to them. But I do think there's a good chance that the pager number she gave was actually JR's, because JR and Denise and Star all say that they paged JR to get drugs. And he says he's coming over for that.
When I hear about a great new book, I no longer get it from the library. I get it from Audible. Audible membership includes one free audiobook a month, exclusive sales, and 30% off of all regularly priced audiobooks. Audible content isn't just audiobooks. It's also original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. They have free apps for the iPhone, the iPad, the Android, and the Windows Phone. And you can download and listen on an iOS device, Android, Amazon Fire tablet, or Windows Phone. And unlike a streaming or rental service, with Audible, you own your books. And with your My Library, you can access your books anytime, anywhere, right from your smartphone. And Audible has the Great Listen Guarantee. If you didn't like it, you can swap it. Now, recently I used Audible to get Killers of the Flower Moon, The Osage Murders, and The Birth of the FBI by David Gran. Now, here's the unique thing about an audiobook. There are three distinct sections of the book, and there are three separate narrators, Anne-Marie Lee, Will Patton, and Danny Campbell. And they weave a compelling story that is amplified all the more by it being an audiobook. And now, Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/UA and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. You can download a title and start listening. It's that easy. So go to audible.com/UA or text UA to 500-500 to get started today.
So do you think that the person that Star actually identified in that second interview, the Hakeem Mohammed, I mean, that's different than Mello, obviously, the person she identified in the first one. So and then, of course, later on, she's identifying Terrence. So, I mean, does this mean that her testimony is just pretty much thrown out? I mean, it's so confused at this point.
Yeah, well, she was right about JR, but she knew him the best of all of them. So that kind of makes sense. It does. So there's the three people in the house. There's the shotgun wielder, the actual triggerman, and then JR, the guy with no gun, who was just kind of standing there. And so she's the JR identification seems certain. He admits it. She knew him, had reason to know him. That seems right. As for the shotgun wielder, she later identifies as Terrence. She calls the same person Hakeem Saleh Muhammad and, you know, has description of him that, you know, where he deal drugs. And it's possible there's a real person out there she's thinking of in her mind that matches the description. It's just a matter of finding him. And then there's, of course, Mello, which presumably is Jamel Lawson. As for the third guy, yeah, I don't even know what to think there. I have no reason to doubt that Jamel Lawson is Mello, but I don't really have strong reasons to believe he is either, because there's just no evidence one way or another about that.
So it would appear that the police took, you know, conflicting information and just tried to hone it down to, you know, three people they thought did it for whatever set of reasons. I have no idea if they sincerely believed that Terrence was the person or not.
I think they believed it, but the Crime Stoppers tip, I think, is what happened. Mm-hmm. They got that and they decided they knew who it was. And at that point, they weren't going back unless Star couldn't identify him.
Mm-hmm. And this is a side question. Does Star have a criminal record?
Yeah, a little bit of one. Mm-hmm. She was a couple of the witnesses refer to her as a notorious crackhead. So she was known for being a drug addict in the neighborhood, and she had some record. Not other than we did describe one incident she was involved with that was sort of violent, involving her sister, but none of the guns were loaded.
The only reason I ask is, you know, her story changed so much, and she arrived at Terrence at the time when the police wanted her to arrive at Terrence. And I was just wondering if there might have been some pressure that they could have put on her because of other charges.
So I don't think it would have that at all. That's not the kind of pressure that would have been applied here. I don't think that was a factor. I do wonder if there was a similar dynamic going on, not from the police, but people on the street, because when Star was first taken in to the homicide unit the night of the murder, she was at the house. One of the officers picked her up and drove her down to talk to Detective Hughes, and that officer filed his own report about what he saw, experienced that night. And according to him, in the car, she told him first that Mello did it, and then said, "I can't say who did it; they'll kill me." So it seems like she was also had some concerns or fears about what would happen to her if she identified the perpetrators. But then, of course, she does go ahead and seems to identify people she thinks were there. So she got over her fears or was convinced that she would not be at risk.
You know, or we're asking for, you know, concrete judgment from a woman who's in the midst of probably a debilitating drug addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't imagine she's making all the best choices at that time. And she may have just decided to find a suspect just to throw off, you know, if she feared for her life. You know, finding another suspect would, you know, put her in a position where she was safe.
Or it's close enough. She thought it could have been him, so why not question it? At the same time, Star's story, it seems odd to me at several points, particularly having to do with why this drug debt existed and whose it really was. She keeps claiming that it's like a $15 drug debt that Bernard had, which I don't necessarily buy, because as they point out at the trial, she claims that earlier that same day, Mello had come by with someone she didn't know and taken their TV as payment for the debt, which you'd think if it was only $15, that'd probably make it all even and square. The other weird part of her story is that there's actually a witness who says that when this happened early in the day, he says he saw Star arguing with a man he didn't know, you know, take the TV and all that. But when the man tried to drive away, his car wouldn't start, so he was unable to go anywhere. And that man took the police to the car. They wrote down the tag and the VIN number and all that, and then apparently never looked it up. But I still would like, it's too late now, we tried. At this point, you can't actually link the tag number to any individual. But it seems very relevant to me that Star had someone else she was arguing with, apparently trying to collect a drug debt, and we have their car still at the place, and police never pursued that.
I had a question about Detective Hughes. What's his track record like? I mean, has he been subjected to discipline? You know, and if the conviction was overturned based on this evidence, would there be any, you know, any downside for him? I don't know if he's even still on the force.
I have not seen trace of him elsewhere. His name does not stand out to me. I have no knowledge of his other involvement in other cases. I don't know about you, Colin.
Yeah, I don't know. I know it was some of the same detectives in the Sean Thomas case and the Willie Vesey case, so we really dug into their histories. But there wasn't overlap with this case. This was West Philadelphia. And so I really haven't looked into his history. So I can't say one way or another whether there have been other cases where his conduct has been called into question.
And you mentioned in the show that the house arrest program in Philadelphia at the time was the object of some controversy. And I have to say, I'm not surprised, given that they were giving house arrest with GPS bracelet to child rapists.
Convicted ones awaiting sentencing. With I was just about to say that.
So he's been convicted, and you know, it's like, oh, I'm going to go to jail. Okay, you know, just let him go. Just let him go. We'll put a beeper on his ankle, and hopefully he'll stick around. Oh, and by the way, we're not going to monitor him at night. I mean, that was astonishing to me. That was just a jaw dropper.
I was blown away when I was reading it. I was trying to figure out, like, just what it looked like to be on house arrest in Philly at that time, to sort of, you know, see if we could possibly correlate, like, the neighborhood or something. I don't know. But I've seen all these articles about all these crimes being committed on people on house arrest. And it was just like, well, yeah, what did you expect to happen?
Yeah, I cannot imagine the bureaucrat who felt that, you know, we'll monitor them during the day. And then at night, they're on their own recognizance because, you know, night is when crimes don't really happen. So, again, obviously it was the object of deserved derision at the time. But it seems so obviously wrongheaded that it just is astonishing it ever took place.
And what also blows me away is the cops apparently never tried to figure out who was on house arrest, because presumably the name Hakeem Saleh Muhammad, I mean, it could be an alias. They did find some people with that name. They also did investigate. But you think they'd want to try and narrow down the pool of suspects they had. And there couldn't have been that many that roughly match who they're looking for. But yeah, never tried it.
And does the state keep records of the house arrests at that time? I mean, would it be possible to access those lists?
Hopefully. That's a work in progress.
And these were GPS bracelets, so you might even have location information, if possibly.
From what I've seen, yeah. I'm very doubtful that their system was
remotely accurate?
Yeah, competent enough to do that.
Okay, I'm hopeful. You know, I watch Maybe. CSI. I wanted to get to, there was an article a few days ago about a Baltimore judge throwing out an Alford plea. I think it was the Demetrius Smith case. First of all, we've talked about Alford pleas in the past, but Colin, could you give us a small refresher on an Alford plea?
Yeah, the Alford plea is basically the oxymoron of the American criminal justice system. A person facially pleads guilty while maintaining their innocence.
But a lot of judges won't allow Alford pleas because of the inherent dichotomy in them. A lot of jurisdictions don't go for them.
Exactly, for that precise reason, John, that you know, there's a victim in the case. There's the community, and they're going to say, if you want to plead guilty, you have to admit your guilt. The Alford plea is this inherent contradiction where you're pleading guilty, but you're saying, I didn't do it, or sometimes they'll say I blacked out and I can't remember. So a lot of judges don't allow these pleas.
So in the Demetrius Smith case, my understanding was this guy was wrongfully convicted of two different murders in two separate cases. This isn't like there were two people killed in the same place and he was convicted of being there and committing them at one time. No, it was two separate wrongful convictions on two separate murders, which is pretty astonishing. And in this case, it sounded like the judge was angry at the prosecutor for misrepresenting the case. Is that correct?
Yeah, this was a case where the murder at issue was in 2008, and there were two eyewitnesses who had identified Mr. Smith. One, who had since died, claimed he was at a payphone and saw him commit the murder. There was CCTV, and they showed at the time of the shooting there was no one at the payphone, so that testimony obviously didn't make any sense. The other eyewitness was a prostitute who had identified Mr. Smith. It turned out she was 6 miles away and getting treatment for methadone, or getting methadone treatment at the time of the murder, and she claimed she was coerced by the detective into identifying Mr. Smith. And so what happened was, obviously, this was a wrongful conviction, and the prosecutor, rather than just allowing for him to go free, said, you have to take this Alford plea. And this was presented to the judge, who said, no, it's not in the interest of justice to have this man pleading guilty. He's innocent of this crime. And so rather than allowing this Alford plea to stand, the judge threw it out and, you know, declared that Mr. Smith is an innocent man.
You know, obviously, that kind of judicial practicality would be welcome. Because actually, you mentioned in the podcast that part of the state's, when the state came to a decision at one point, they talked about something that Terrence was supposedly alleging when he hadn't been alleging that. And I wondered, you know, very often in decisions and in when prosecutors are pleading their cases, they make errors or say things that turn out later to be false. But there's still no redress for that built into the system, is there?
There are times you can object to that. And it should be sustained. If it's not, you could theoretically make an appeal of it. But it's a really uncommon sort of error to see in appellate decisions, or at least that I've come across.
And could it conceivably be corrected by an overlapping decision? Like, let's say, you know, a federal court took it on, or there was an appeal that was successful that could correct the record?
Possibly, but it's a pretty high bar. I mean, it has to be. I mean, there is leeway given in open closing arguments, so it has to be something that's extremely prejudicial and objected to, and the court has to not take care of it at time for there to be a good chance of it to matter on appeal or to be a basis for overturning a sentence.
Xavier, I actually had a question for you. When you were in prison, did you come across a fair number of people who, you know, the cliche is that all the prisoners claim they didn't do it, you know, but did you feel like there were people who credibly didn't commit the crimes they were put in prison for?
Yeah, I mean, I know individuals personally, who were convicted of crimes that they did not commit, you know, and it has a lot to do, you know, in my city in particular, unfortunately, you know, it had a lot to do with a police force that was very brutal. I'm not sure if you're familiar with the John Birch cases. They had what I often refer to as a torture team, individuals, law enforcement, who would literally, you know, torture, you know, suspects and force them to make confessions to things that they did not commit. Those cases have come to light. Consequences were, you know, sort of, you know, meted out. But sadly, a lot of them are still in prison and their cases are still making it back into the courts. So when I hear innocence claim, you know, I reflect upon my experience. You know, I wasn't innocent of my crime. You know, I was there. I was involved. You know, I was someone who, you know, was a part of this, you know, very, very regretful experience. But, you know, I have to admit, when I went to the homicide unit, when I sat in the interrogation room and when I was handcuffed to the wall, you know, when the police officers walked into the room, I remember one of the homicide detectives, he threw a telephone book on top of the table that was in front of me. And when he started questioning me and when he wasn't satisfied with what I was saying, I remember him hitting me in the head with the telephone book. I remember being punched, being choked and grabbed, and because I refused to tell them what they wanted to hear. And because of that, and sadly, you know, I ended up exacerbating my role in the offense. Although I was guilty, I wasn't quite guilty enough for them in that particular conversation. And because of that, you know, I admitted to things that I didn't even do. And, you know, I pled guilty, and so this was never really addressed in the courtroom. But when I hear claims of innocence, you know, I don't give it a second thought, you know. And I also recognize that, you know, seeing the outcomes of these cases decades later, hearing stories like this and hearing about, you know, even witnesses who admit that their first, you know, accounts of an event was not true or that it may have been tainted by others or fear of harm. I mean, I realize that the justice system is very, you know, very much, it's not immune to human error, you know, and it's certainly not immune to, you know, the motivations and drives of people who may not, you know, necessarily care about justice, but simply want to get a conviction. And sadly, many lives have been impacted by that.
Yeah, most people's, you know, perception of those kind of things have been, you know, from movies and television. And you know, people always respect the tough cop who's, you know, a master interrogator who, you know, scares the prisoners into being truthful. That's the cliche. But when people hear stories like yours, you see the flip side of it, that brutality is brutality.
When my wife and I were getting married, everything related to our wedding registry was a nightmare. We went to a department store. They gave us a barcode scanner. We spent hours going around the department store. Things weren't registering, didn't have quite what we wanted. And then the guests at our wedding had real difficulty navigating the website to buy us the items we wanted. We figured there has to be a better way, and now there is. It's Zola. It's fun, it's free, it's easy to use. Zola Registry has everything you love about your favorite department store, plus things like honeymoon funds, fitness classes, wine subscriptions, and so much more. They have over 500 top brands and 50,000 gifts, experiences, and cash funds. It's so easy to use for couples and their guests. Their friendly customer service team will go above and beyond, helping pick out the perfect blender, walking a grandmother through a couple's registry, and more. And their group gifting feature lets multiple guests contribute to big-ticket gifts. Plus, you can personalize your registry with photos and notes about why you're coveting certain gifts. And they have price matching and free shipping every day. It's the top-rated app for iPhone, iPad, and Apple Watch, so couples can manage their registries on the go. And now, Undisclosed listeners, you have this special deal. To sign up with Zola and receive a $50 credit toward your registry, go to zola.com/UA. That's zola.com/UA.
Well, we have some social media questions that I hope you guys are up for. This is from Appreciates Nick, who asks, is there any idea when the decision in Adnan's case will be coming? And people always want to hear Adnan updates. Do we have anything?
I guess theoretically we're coming up towards the end of the month. It could be, when's the next watch, Colin, do you know?
It'll be next Tuesday, the 30th. So that last couple days of January, basically it's the last Tuesday of every month. I saw someone say the statistics that said they had clear almost all of cases before the Court of Special Appeals within 8 months after the hearing. So I think this will be 7 months. Next month will be 8 months. So I think there's a pretty good chance we'll see a ruling coming either the end of January or the end of February.
Yes, I've completely given up reading the tea leaves on any of this. I always, you know, would question lawyers and say, come on, you know, you must have some real insight. And I now understand the resigned sigh that they always make, which is just these things take as long as they take. And they could go either way. And obviously, I'm you know, my personal bias is that that I believe his appeal should stand. Okay, so here we've got another question from Jim Lai, who says, listening to the latest undisclosed addendum, doesn't it just take one judge finding the AEDPA unconstitutional as applied in the face of a finding of actual innocence to force change?
It would take more than that. I mean, theoretically, I mean, it always starts with one, and that case goes up and goes up, and then you hopefully get a favorable ruling from the Supreme Court. But I don't think that's particularly likely in the current environment. I mean, I don't see enough votes being there on the Supreme Court. Do you, Colin?
Yeah, I mean, it would be one domino, but it's not something like a domino effect. So if a judge in, say, Oklahoma decided this is unconstitutional, well, that would be great for defendants in Oklahoma, assuming it's upheld in appeal, but that's not really going to have resonance. I mean, other judges could certainly cite to it, but that would not be binding authority on any other court.
But, Jim, awesome question.
It's definitely thinking about
ways. I think legislatively is the best way to fix the ADPA issue.
Yeah.
Speaking of which, legislatively, there's actually been a bill introduced in the Georgia State Senate seeking to make it law, legislative law, that the trial tapes for court cases are publicly available.
Yes, I heard about that. That's very exciting.
Early stages yet, but I'm hopeful that's something that can get pushed through.
Now, obviously, Undisclosed's case was instrumental in bringing that issue to light. But did you guys actually have any communications with the politician who is the representatives who's actually bringing that law to the floor?
No, I only found out about it because Claire had some Google alerts set up for the podcast, and she got a message from them and told me about it. So hopefully, I know that our attorneys have reached out to them and have offered support. So hopefully something can happen there.
Well, that would be great. Okay, here we've got something from Antoine Letarte, who says, I know I've heard things on the podcast that juries didn't, but in all your cases, I can't help but think, how the heck did these juries find this evidence to be proving the case beyond reasonable doubt?
I mean, keep in mind, you are hearing only, you're not hearing the prosecution side, and you're hearing a different set of people present the case. In some cases, you have the problem of an ineffective advocate who is not making strong arguments, is not presenting well. And so you're left instead with just the state's case, which on its own might seem much more compelling.
Also, witnesses who, on the face of it, you know, and in retrospect, don't sound particularly convincing, sometimes in the room are. You know, apparently Jay Wilds was very convincing in the room. You know, that's something that juries talk about often, that they, you know, they find some people believable in these situations.
Or take Star. Like, there are lots of questions they could have asked her, which would definitely have put into relief a lot of the problems in her story. But without those questions being asked, she undoubtedly seemed much more credible as a witness.
Okay, we've got one from Katie Carroll, who says, longtime listener, first-time tweeter. Is it crazy for Terrence Lewis to sue the state of Pennsylvania for false imprisonment?
Not crazy at all. Sean Thomas, for instance, the individual who the conviction review unit threw out his conviction, has brought an action against the city and the officers. And the typical code that's used, it's 42 U.S. Code Section 1983. It is a claim of deprivation of civil rights. So it is basically a constitutional civil rights claim. This is typically what people who are wrongfully convicted would bring. And the allegation would be, in essence, I was deprived of my rights because you either withheld evidence or you pressured witnesses or whatever you did to lead to my conviction when otherwise I would not have been convicted.
And since you guys have found evidence of a possible Brady violation, that would certainly be brought to the fore in that kind of a proceeding, correct?
Sure. Yeah, that would be a possibility, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we've got another question from Jenny. Oh, and by the way, Katie, welcome to Twitter. thank you for your participation. We love hearing from you anytime. But our next one is from Jenny, and it says, after the handwritten notes came up and after Starr's statements became more unreliable, why did the jury and the police not research further in another direction or concentrate more on all the other witnesses who confirmed Terrence wasn't at the crime scene that day?
Well, the jury never heard, the jury shouldn't research anything on their own, but also the jury never heard from the other witnesses. Those all came up post-trial, years later. So there was no evidence of any outside witnesses, and as far as the police file goes, no record of any existing, because I didn't bother to find any. So that the jury didn't have that to consider in the first place. But as for why the cops didn't, I have no idea.
Again, you know, you have to remember the murder rate in Philadelphia at the time had skyrocketed. You know, this was not probably a super high priority case because it happened in a drug den to people in the midst of a drug deal that went bad. So, you know, I have to figure the police just, you know, didn't feel like it had the sense of urgency that other cases might have had.
Yeah. So, Susan, we got this late arriving social media question. It's from Brigitta Isilov-Like. And she asks, just listen to the latest episode regarding the Omar note. Is it not possible that the interviewed is Sam, the other man who's been mentioned being at the crime scene? Great episode as always.
Yeah, that's one thing I definitely wondered as well. And part of why I kept going back to those notes, I started to question whether Omar could have ever whether Omar had been at the crime scene at all, and if he could have possibly given a statement about it. And Omar is the person who, or Omar's the one that Star says in the room. Sam's the one that both Denise, the other woman in the house, as well as one of the outside witnesses, Marsha Whitlock, claims was the other old man there. We don't know anything more on Sam. There's no record of the last name, no record of the police trying to find him. There's no record of the police even knowing to look for him until they found Denise. So the timeline is we have the shooting on August 6th. On August 19th, so like 2 weeks later, we have the Star interview that leads to the Omar 60 and Walnut notes. And then many, many, many months later, in April next year, 97, so what, that's a better part of a year, they finally find Denise. And for the very first time, she says, no, Omar wasn't there. It was a guy named Sam. So until that moment, they didn't know who Sam was. Which that was, again, April of 97. So for, I can't do math, like at least 9 months after the Omar 16 Walnut notes happened. We know those notes took place in August because on those notes, the police learn of several other witnesses' names and addresses, which they did not have before then. But on the 19th and the 20th of August, they followed up on. So those notes were written down within a couple weeks of the murder happening and therefore can't be Sam because they have no idea Sam is even a person that possibly could exist.
So, Xavier, did you have any questions for Colin and Susan?
No, just really intrigued. And I listened to the first 2.5 episodes and I'm not quite caught up all the way. But yeah, just hearing the details and hearing how it plays out and really just appreciating the fact that you are shedding a light upon this case in such a way, to me is very meaningful. You know, I know a lot of people who are in prison, who have claims of innocence. I know a lot of people who've been in prison since they were children, and sadly they're still there. And so it sort of has like a double, feel for me in regards to the issues, in regards to what's important as it relates to what justice means, particularly for children and especially for those who are innocent. I just really want to say thanks to all of you for really focusing in and giving his case, his plight, some light and opportunity for others to weigh in and to urge, our society to do what's right.
Now, is there anything that the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth is working on right now that listeners could conceivably help with? Like, is there a particular state that you guys are targeting to try and change legislation in, or some campaign that you're working on right now?
Yes, thankfully last year, we were able to have some wonderful successes. We were able to end life without parole in North Dakota, Arkansas, and speaking of the legislative session, we were able to end it in the District of Columbia. And just recently in California, because of the stern advocacy of many people there, they ended the practice there altogether as well. And so life without parole is solely being taken off of our map, But, this year, I don't know if I should give the full battle plan, but I would say that we are in several states right now. We are looking at Ohio. We are looking at, Oklahoma, Minnesota. These are states where sadly, lifestyle pro is still a part of the sentencing options, and sadly, many people's lives are still in the balance. And many people's lives are still languishing away there in those prisons. And we want to be able to go, to these states and the ways which people can help, obviously, is speaking to your legislators, supporting our work. We hope to have media coming out soon. We're pushing op-eds. We have a strategic media plan. We also are working with potential and existing bill sponsors. Interesting enough, we look at the past 2 to 3 years, the red states have been leading the way. And you're talking to a black and Mexican kid from the south side of Chicago, and for me, a lot of this is just a learning experience and just realizing that, our work, really does, change lives. It touches hearts. It helps people understand that, kids are different and deserving of an opportunity for positive change. And I'm seeing that, there are many people on both sides of the aisle that believe the same. And so I would simply say support our work. Visit www.fairsentencingofyouth.org. I would also encourage you to join our Facebook page as well as the Facebook page of our national network, which is called the Incarcerated Children's Advocacy Network. This national network consists of over 70 members from 25 states, all of which were convicted of homicide-related offenses when they were kids, and or sentenced to life without parole when they were kids. But they're out now, thanks to the sentencing reforms, thanks to, you know, U.S. Supreme Court decisions and other legal interventions in their lives, they've been able to come out and recreate their lives, and now they're partnering with us across the country, and they are making opportunities possible that were also afforded to them. And so, it's just, you know, overall, I would just say, you know, remain positive, be optimistic. You know, a lot of great things are happening, but with your support, many more can come.
Well, thank you, Xavier. Thank you so much for being here. Thank you, Colin and Susan.
Thank you, John.
Do you guys have anything you want to pipe in with?
Yeah, well, that flows in nicely. Next week, we will be having an episode, a special episode, on the Centoya Brown case, which involves juvenile sentencing in Tennessee. Tennessee still has juvenile life without parole. Their second option is life with the possibility of parole after serving 51 years, so minimum 51-year sentence. We'll be covering that next week, and making a call to listeners to contact Tennessee legislators to try to reform that law.
Fantastic. Well, I am looking forward. Thank you guys so much. And I think that's it for this week's addendum. Thank you so much for listening to this week's addendum. We're going to be off for a couple of weeks, but if you feel like checking out our website, it is undisclosed-podcast.com. And as you know, there is a list of all the criminal justice-related charities that we've been donating to in the past, including the Campaign for Fair Sentencing of Youth, Xavier's charity. So if you want to connect with them, you can go through our website and click through and get right to theirs. As of now, I'm donating all my fees for this series to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, and you can help them as well at their website, innocenceprojectpa.org. You can follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at their handle, @UndisclosedPod, and send any questions with the hashtag UDAddendum. I want to thank my assistant, Andrew Congdon, for his research. Every week, he's coming through like a champ. I also want to thank Hannah McCarthy for audio production, Patrick Cortez, who composed our addenda theme, and Methil Telhan, our project manager. So thank you so much once again, and I can't wait till we meet again in a few weeks.